The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Today's podcast heads off into deep space with astrobiologist Caleb Scharf and science fiction star Anne Leckie. Leckie's debut, Ancillary Justice, melds high-concept space opera with pacey revenge quest and won an extraordinary collection of SF's most prestigious awards, the Hugo, the BSFA, the Clark and the Nebula. She joins us to talk non-human narrators, the music of the spheres, and how imagined far future politics can have real-world effects on the here and now. But before we take flight into fiction, we're exploring the mind-bending facts of existence with Columbia University's Director of Astrobiology, Caleb Scharf. His latest book, The Copernicus Complex, describes recent advances in astrophysics and molecular biology, which have put us in the extraordinary position of contemplating scientific answers to questions like, where do we come from? Scharf argues that this progress has been grounded in two scientific principles which pull in opposite directions. So when he spoke down the line from New York City, he started by exploring the Copernican principle and why its crucial insight, that planet Earth is just nowhere in particular, has been so fruitful.
Well, obviously the Copernican principle is something that traces back to Copernicus, although it's not, strictly speaking, something that he proposed. So when he placed the sun at the center of our solar system, he really set in motion an idea that grew and grew over the following decades and centuries, that we inhabit a place that is inconsequential, that we're not central to the universe in any way, and that our circumstances are entirely common. There's nothing special about us, nothing special about life on Earth, or indeed the perch from which we observe the universe. And that, over time, has become known as the Copernican principle. So in a sense, it's a principle of cosmic mediocrity. We're just a speck on a crumb circling another crumb in a vast cavern of space, and there are lots of other places like that out there. It has enabled science to ask questions in a way it wouldn't have otherwise. So, for example, when we can look to just last century, when Einstein and others were applying the tools of general relativity to understanding the universe as a whole, it was a tremendously important thing to be able to say, you know, our vantage point is not special and there is no center to the universe. In fact, that is embedded in the mathematical equations describing our universe, that there is no physical center, there's no spatial center. So I think if we hadn't had the Copernican ideas, we would have come up against a wall, because we, you know, if we're still thinking that we were absolutely special in some way or central in some way, we wouldn't have been able to make these scientific leaps.
It's a very kind of egalitarian principle, isn't it? It's very democratic. It's almost got a sort of socialist feel to it.
Well, it is a wonderful idea, isn't it? And I think, you know, for scientists, it has a certain appeal that it's, yes, as you say, it's a sort of socialist ideal that we're all made equal, not just here on Earth, but if there's a civilization somewhere else, they'll be exactly the same. They're equally inconsequential. Nobody has any true right to anything in the universe. So the fascinating thing for me is that while we have this evidence for a decentralized universe, at the same time, our innate human tendency is to think that we're important. And obviously, at the time of Copernicus, this was entrenched in the sort of scientific thinking of the time, that of course we were central, that there's something special about our existence in the universe. So there is this extraordinary tension between the way we deal with the world around us and the intellectual notion backed up by our observation of nature that actually we're completely inconsequential. And this is really the complex we have, the Copernican complex that we have, this sort of dysfunctional relationship between the ideas that we're somehow significant in the universe and all the evidence to the contrary, that we're completely insignificant. We're not central or special in any way.
Pulling the other way, both kind of scientifically and politically, is another principle, the anthropic principle. What's the kind of motivation here?
Well, the anthropic principle is something that emerged starting in around the 1970s or so, when a number of physicists began to realize that the fundamental properties of our universe, the very basic things that determine the nature of our universe, for example, the strength of gravitational forces or the strength of electromagnetic forces, fundamental constants that even now we have no theory for predicting. They are what they are. The universe has formed this way. But if you altered any of those fundamental characteristics by just a small amount, the argument went, you would subvert the pathway to life. For example, the universe wouldn't make stars in the way that it makes stars, and those stars wouldn't make carbon. And of course, we're based on carbon chemistry. And there are other factors too, things to do with what happened in the very early universe and even the number of spatial dimensions in the universe. Now, obviously, life wouldn't be here to make that observation if it weren't that way. But if this were the only universe, the once and only universe, then you have to ask, well, why did it turn out this way? If there's nothing that really says it had to be this way. And so people realize this, in principle, makes life something extraordinarily important. It's the antithesis of the Copernican ideal. Suddenly, life appears to be perhaps central to the universe.
It's almost kind of an authoritarian vision of it, that the universe is set up to suit us. We kind of rule it.
Absolutely, yes. That's a marvelous way of putting it. Of course, the universe would do our bidding. And naturally, that's a disquieting idea, especially after several centuries from Copernicus, and we had all sort of settled into this idea of cosmic mediocrity. One possible solution that these days is certainly a very popular possibility is this idea of the multiverse, the idea that this isn't the only universe, so that the apparent suitability of this universe for us is just because we live in one of an unimaginable number of different universes, different realities separated by space, time, or dimension, that happens to be suitable for life.
There's ways in which the Copernican principle itself is starting to look a little shaky. I mean, what are the kind of leading clues that there's actually something special about life on Earth after all?
There are a number of interesting factors that come into this. And I suppose one of the most recent discoveries, of course, has been that there are indeed other planets around other stars. Now, 20 years ago, we didn't know that for sure, although we might have suspected it. And we now, thanks to the efforts of astronomers building extremely sensitive instruments, we know of more than about 4,000 candidate planets around other stars, and enough to make statistical statements. We know that the universe, or at least our galaxy, makes stars in abundance. Now, on the face of it, that's supporting the Copernican principle. It's just saying, yes, we're just one solar system. The really interesting thing is that if we look at the details, we discovered that our solar system, the configuration of the orbits, the types of planets, the type of star that we orbit, place our solar system in a somewhat small club. We're perhaps a 1 in 100 type place. And there are other pieces of evidence that suggest there may have been a number of special things happening here to give rise to life. So to give you one example that actually comes from biology, the cells of complex creatures like us, animals, cows, chickens, plants, fungus, things like that, contain mitochondria. And mitochondria are a little energy power plant, and they give our cells that energy boost that allows us to become big and complex and to do many more things than simple bacteria. The biologists have pointed out that the reason for mitochondria in our cells and the reason for our cells being the way they are may have hinged on an extremely unlikely merger of two simpler organisms some 2 billion years ago. And if that one single event hadn't happened, quite literally between two individual organisms, we wouldn't be here. And so the argument goes that that means that the existence of complex life anywhere in the universe may be contingent on some very, very unlikely steps. in which case we're back to looking at ourselves as being somewhat special.
So you're suggesting that we need a kind of middle way between these two opposing principles. What's your proposal?
Well, that's right, because I think when you are faced with good evidence on both sides of an argument, it probably means that you need a different type of argument to resolve those two pieces of evidence. And there are other pieces of evidence suggesting the common nature of life in the universe, and also other pieces of evidence suggesting a somewhat special condition for life here on Earth. And I think the solution may reside in broadening our conception of what something like life really is. And if we look in the cosmos, we discover that, well, things like planets and chemistry and perhaps life as well inhabit an interesting regime, somewhere between chaos and order. And the interesting thing about that regime, and it's a regime defined by thermodynamics, so whether things are too hot or too cold, whether things are physically too ordered or disordered, but life, at least on Earth, definitely pops up in that interface between chaos and order. You need a sort of just right zone for life to occur in. And that gives us a clue, because it tells us that there may be many different pathways to either simple or complex life, that the trajectories followed in our own history may represent merely one example of a multitude of possible ways to arrive at a similar place. Not necessarily humans sitting around drinking coffee and eating fish and chips, but you know, some other equally complex, conceivably intelligent life. So the answer I propose is that we may be unique but not exceptional. In other words, life on Earth has followed its pathway, and that pathway may not be duplicated exactly anywhere else in the universe. However, to save cosmic mediocrity, this implies that there should be lots of other life out there, lots of other examples of equally complex life, saying, well, I wonder if this has happened anywhere else. So I think this is a sort of middle ground. It's a sort of cosmo-chaotic principle. It's defining a place between order and chaos where many, many different outcomes can exist. Now, the beauty of it is we can test this. And right now, astronomers and scientists are engaged in the search for life elsewhere. So it's possible in the next 10 to 15 years we'll have some sort of answer to this.
But you argue that the search for life beyond Earth has always been at the back of researchers' minds, but has now become the kind of stated primary goal behind many funding applications. What is it that makes that search for life so very important? Is it answering this very question?
Well, I think it is. It is answering this very question. It's also, you know, let's be honest about it, it's something that has a deep meaning, I think, for all of us. This notion of whether there's anything else out there, whether we are somehow special, we can't get away from that. And at a very personal, intellectual level, just thinking about other creatures elsewhere, for some reason, has a real grip on us. And now, of course, scientifically, if we want to understand our own origins thoroughly, it's difficult when we have one example, we have one planet, one history of life to make use of. And that may be holding us up in answering, where did we all come from? What was the origin point of life? And you know, understanding that in terms of chemistry and physics, it's a lot easier if you have other experiments, if you have other examples. So it would be taking the one single experiment of life on Earth and adding many other experiments if we could find other examples of life. So in fact, it comes back to answering the questions of our own origins. So the peculiar thing is, it's actually, I suppose, it's still a very selfish quest. we're trying to understand ourselves by understanding others.
Is part of the reason for exobiology's newfound importance that funding panels with eminent professors on them are now full of the people who grew up reading Isaac Asimov or Robert Heinlein or whatever?
Well, it's a good question, and I think there may be something to that. I think, you know, the beauty of science fiction is it allows us to explore ideas that we might otherwise be cautious to think about, and certainly as scientists. So I think it's probably true. Yes, we've all been well soaked in the doctrine of science fiction, and obviously the best science fiction is exceedingly well thought through, and it picks philosophical and scientific questions and extrapolates the implications from those. So, yes, you know, we're probably all deep down, we would like for there to be a little more fantasy in life, and we're curious. We're curious. Are these speculations actually going to turn out, some of them, to be true?
What do you make of the kind of aliens that science fiction writers cook up? Are they, well, alien enough?
In general, I suspect they're not alien enough. I think even if life everywhere follows the same basic biochemical building blocks, which I think is quite likely because it's the chemistry we see everywhere in the universe, the actual outcome, I think, has potential to be remarkably different. Now, of course, we'll have to wait and see. But yes, you know, even if you look at something like Star Wars or Star Trek now, of course, I guess budgetary constraints mean that most aliens are walking around on 2 feet, but they probably aren't stretching it quite far enough. And certainly when it comes to questions of intelligence, and I think you only have to look at the Earth itself to look at, for example, the octopus. The octopus is clearly an intelligent creature, but it's extremely different. It's extremely alien. I can't imagine holding a conversation with an octopus ever. And that could equally be the case with life elsewhere.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace. When it's time to create a website for whatever's newsworthy in your life, whether that's a small business, online store, professional portfolio, or just a blog, go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
If the scientific imagination is shaped by science fiction, then one of the writers who'll be shaping research budgets for the next generation of boffins is Anne Leckie. Leckie came comparatively late to fiction, publishing her first short story, Hesperia and Glory, at the age of 40 in 2006. Her first novel, Ancillary Justice, follows Breck, the last remaining fragment of a vast artificial intelligence, as she travels to the centre of the Empire to confront the Lord of the Raj and exact revenge. In the trilogy's second instalment, Ancillary Sword, Breck finds herself back in command of a starship, but despite her newfound authority, she finds she's boxed in once more. Leckie began by taking us to the ship's gym, where Breck's old anger is burning fierce and strong.
I went to the ship's small gym, a few last Amats scurrying out of my way. Worked out hard for an hour. Went, still angry, still sweaty from exercise, to the firing range. It was all simulation. No one wanted bullets flying on a small ship, not with hard vacuum outside the hull. The targets were images ship cast on the far wall. The weapon would bang and recoil as though it had fired real bullets, but it shot only light. Not as destructive as I wanted to be that very moment. But it would have to do. Ship knew my mood. It threw up a quick succession of targets, all of which I hit, nearly unthinking. Reloaded. No need to reload, really, but there would be if this had been a real weapon, and so the training routines demanded it. Fired again and again. Reloaded again. Fired. It wasn't enough. Seeing that, ship set the targets moving, a dozen of them at a time. I settled into a familiar rhythm. Fire. Reload. Fire. Reload. A song came into my mind. There was always a song with me. This one was a long narrative, an account of the final dispute between Anandrami and I and her erstwhile friend, Niskaya Eskour. The poet had been executed 1,500 years ago. Her version of the event had cast Anandra as the villain and ended with the promise that the dead Niskaya would return to revenge herself. It had been almost utterly forgotten inside Raj space, because singing it, possibly even knowing it existed, could easily cost a citizen a thorough re-education. It still circulated some places outside Raj influence. Betrayer, long ago we promised to exchange equally gift for gift. Take this curse. What you destroy will destroy you. Fire, reload. Fire, reload. Doubtless little of the song, or any other on the same subject, had any basis in fact. Doubtless the event itself had been quite mundane, not so poetically dramatic, ringing with mythic and prophetic overtones. It was still satisfying to sing it. I came to the end, lowered my weapon. Unbidden, ship showed me what was behind my back. 3 Atrepas crowding the entrance to the firing range, watching, astonished. Savardin, on her way to her own quarters in bed, standing behind them. She could not read my mood as closely as Ship could, but she knew me well enough to be worried. 97%, said Ship in my ear, needlessly. I took a breath, stowed the weapon in its niche, turned. The expressions of the three Atrepas turned instantly from astonishment to blank, ancillary-like expressionlessness, and they stepped back into the corridor. I brushed past them, out into the corridor and away, toward the bath. Heard one Atrepa say, "Fuck, is that what special missions is like?" Saw the panic of the others. Their last captain had been very strict about swearing. Heard Savardin, outwardly jovial, say, "Fleet captain is pretty fucking badass." The vulgarity, combined with Savardin's archaic, elegant accent, set them laughing, relieved but still unsettled. Mercy of Collar didn't ask me why I was angry, didn't ask me what was wrong. That, in and of itself, suggested my suspicions were correct. I wished, for the first time in my 2,000-year life, that I was given to swearing.
Where did it all start? Was it the challenge of telling a story from the perspective of a non-human narrator?
So it started with, and I think a lot of writers do this, you know, when you're bored or you're in line or whatever, and you're putting things together in your head, and eventually it sort of accreted a lot of stuff. And I said, oh, here's a universe that's kind of cool. And one of the components of that was the idea of a ship AI with ancillaries. And once I'd thought about that enough, I said, well, oh, here's a story for one of these characters, but oh my gosh, it really needs to be in first person. It really needs to be from that character's perspective. And that, yeah, that was a huge challenge. And I had to take a long time and a lot of thought as to how I was going to be able to do that.
For those who haven't met her yet, could you just talk us through exactly who and what Breck is and what the ancillaries are?
So Breck is an ancillary, and essentially, the Rajshai have these warships that a part of the ship itself is human bodies that have been forcibly slaved to the ship to sort of act for the ship. The bodies are still alive. The people who were made into the ancillaries were none too happy about it happening, but they no longer exist as individuals, which is really pretty horrific, actually. And so Breck is an ancillary from a ship that has been destroyed. She's all that's left of the ship.
But she's not just the kind of human fragment, is she? She's way much more than that.
Yeah. And the question of identity became a really big issue once I started working on the character. I thought suddenly identity becomes really important. It wasn't something I noticed when I thought of the character, but the more I tried to write her, the more the question of who anybody is became really important to how I portrayed somebody whose identity was really kind of strange, actually, a sort of multi-part. And so the question of who exactly she is kind of weird and ambiguous, actually.
Did you have literary models in mind for this multi-voice, kind of multi-perspective character?
Not deliberately. I probably did because I think, like every writer, you work with all the things that you've read in the background, but I can't think of one that I deliberately used as a model to construct it with. It wouldn't surprise me if somebody would say, oh, you read this thing and look, it follows through this way. But
that's not the way around it worked for you. You started from the character and then found the tools on your own watch, as it were.
Right, yeah.
How did you go about imagining yourself into the head of this distributed intelligence?
That was tricky. It was very tricky. I had the idea for this character way back in the early 2000s and did not even feel like I could begin to do that until like around 2005. And even then it took me ages to actually write it down. So it was really just sort of by feel.
Yeah, I mean, for most of the book, and indeed at the beginning, she's in a sort of this halfway house state where she's kind of been stripped down. We only introduced to her as Justice of Torin, as the kind of entire ship later on. I mean, is that partly to let the reader into her world, or is that also how you came across it as a writer as well?
Yeah, I think it's both. It was easier to introduce from just that single perspective. Those chapters were easier to write. And it's easier for a reader to begin to be familiar with the character and then be introduced to the more complicated aspects later, absolutely.
I was wondering if that's partly where the songs came from, again, to give a kind of more human side to this very non-human character.
Partly. Part of it was that in trying to get into the head of such a character, I'm thinking to myself, well, okay, I have 20 bodies, right? What would I do if I had 20 bodies? And one of my first thoughts was I could sing choral music all by myself. And I realized that not everybody in the world would have that immediate reaction. But I thought, yeah, I would totally do that. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, no, this really works for this character.
Because you've used actual shape note tunes, and there's old tunes as well, really old tunes.
Yes, there are two shape note tunes in Ancillary Justice, and there's one medieval tune that's actually really quite famous, which partly I put in there because it's much easier than writing my own stuff, right? And of course, those are all public domain. But also, when writers try to add music or songs as part of their fiction, sometimes I feel like it can go very badly wrong. And one of the ways that it happens is that as a writer, of course, I'm feeling all the feels, you know, it's all very resonant to me, but it doesn't necessarily get across to the reader. And sometimes you can say, oh, I'll put this song in and it has these associations for me and it will be very rich and it'll give this, you know, emotional feel, but it doesn't necessarily to the reader. And particularly made up songs don't have that sort of weight of history behind them that's really important to giving songs and poetry their weight that means so much to a person. And so to some extent, choosing real songs, I was sort of trying to draw on the real world history of those songs. Of course, it doesn't help that they're kind of obscure for certain values of obscure, right?
Yeah, but I guess a 2,000-year-old character needs some kind of old material as well, doesn't she?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I also wanted to avoid the sort of, I love Star Trek, and I don't mean to say anything bad about it, but Star Trek appears to only have classic art and music from the 20th century.
Absolutely. Breck's world is remote from our own in other ways as well. Your Radkai don't care much about gender, you say, and their language doesn't mark gender in any way. It's a feature you've rendered in English as her every time. Was this a direct challenge to those in the SFF community who think the most important thing about a lady editor is whether she's beauty pageant beautiful?
So it wasn't meant to be a direct challenge. And in fact, the novel was finished and being shopped around when that particular incident occurred.
Sure.
But at the same time, I had been listening to conversations about gender and about diversity and about representation during the whole time that I was writing the book. And so those conversations and my personal conclusions about those conversations cannot help but have made their way into the book.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's just the things you were thinking about were indeed the forces that led the SFWA to put a picture of a chainmail bikini-wearing woman on the front of a magazine. So that these issues were kind of in your mind in
right.
The same way that they were kind of in the society's mind, I suppose.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the debut novel, Ancillary Justice, carried off this unprecedented quadruple haul with the Hugo, the Nebula, the BSFA, and the Arthur C. Clarke as well. I mean, does this prize attention give you a kind of platform to address these kind of issues?
It possibly does. I'm still trying to process all that actually having happened and still trying to really believe that they're real. I mean, I can turn my head and look at my mantle and see them all there, but I'm still not sure they're really actually there. But to a certain extent, it does give me a wider audience and a platform. At the same time as I believe, for instance, that all fiction is political, I don't want to get into a situation where all my fiction is deliberately trying to push a particular message. I would rather say, here's what I believe in. And here it is, and you think about what you want to think about it, rather than here's a lesson I want you to learn, you know. So I'm still kind of working out how I feel about that and what that says about my future. Yeah.
Yeah, but there's no kind of retreat in book two in Ancillary Sword, where Breck is turns into some sort of commie.
She could.
Seriously, she always goes for the bottom of every hierarchy. She turns up at this plantation planet, got a very sort of Indian Raj kind of tea-style drinking planet, and looks for the citizen Fossif, who says that behind most problems there's always one or two field workers who get whipped up by agitators. They go on strike, but there's no point in refusing to feed them because it's a planet and so on. And Breck she goes very much for the bottom end of things and tries to support these people.
Yeah, absolutely she does. That's absolutely. And I mean, that's kind of part of who she is, right?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's a quieter kind of novel. There's explosions for sure and a proper set piece finale, but it's mostly this kind of pastoral feel on this tea planet. Are you kind of drawing breath for round three?
To some extent, yeah. I was also sort of thinking about, you know, when you're having wars in space, right? Space is really freaking big. I could explain how big space is, and I myself could still not wrap my brain around it. So if you're going to have war in space, you're going to have huge amounts of time of just sitting around waiting for people to turn up, let alone a realistic space battle would be like firing off a projectile and waiting for 6 weeks for it to reach its target, right?
Yeah.
And so I said, well, it doesn't make sense that she's going to arrive at this place and bang, war is going to break out. It just doesn't make any sense at all. Plus, there are these other sort of social things that might be kind of fun to explore. So yeah, to some extent, I'm deliberately saying, no, it's not going to all explode at once. Let's take a breath and let's kind of look around and see where we're at.
That's a very scientifically grounded attitude to have there. We're at this kind of extraordinary time of development in astrophysics. We've got more than 1,000 extrasolar planets discovered by this year. I mean, how do these scientific advances link up with the SF imagination?
Well, I think, you know, every writer and reader kind of has to decide for themselves how that's going to work out. Because, of course, a lot of scientific developments have the potential to really explode science fictional dreams very badly. I remember when the final set of those pictures from Mars, there were several probes that went and sent pictures, and that first set was really devastating. But as more and more pictures kept coming back and it became really obvious that there was nothing on Mars but rocks, that really dealt a huge blow to science fiction. You'll see that stories about Mars completely change their tenor round about that time. And you won't find those sort of planetary romance Mars stories after that date.
Have you got any kind of clue about what's happening with part three? And we've got the Presger lurking in the background. And it's another challenge for the SF writer, isn't it, to come up with aliens that are really alien enough?
Yes, it is. It's very difficult because if you're going to relate to them as characters, it becomes almost impossible if they're really truly alien. But if they're not really truly alien, then are they really aliens or are they people in funny hats? And so, yeah, so that's a problem. I'm working on three. And I know how it's going to end. And I've seen a few people say, oh, how could she possibly wrap this up in a trilogy? There's no way. It'll be wrapped up in a trilogy. Y'all can trust me.
Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice and Ancillary Sword are both published in the UK by Orbit, while Alan Lane publishes Caleb Scharf's The Copernicus Complex. Next week we'll be joining Robert McFarlane on the trail as he comes to the Guardian Book Club to talk about The Old Ways. You can subscribe on iTunes, follow us on SoundCloud, or listen to us on the Guardian website. Just search for Guardian Books Podcast. From me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Eva Krizyak, see you next time.